But the bigger question that I have is, again, go back to things I've talked about in the past, which is who's in control of the escalatory ladder? You know, what is the escalator? What ladder are we talking about? And who's in control of that ladder? And what I see out of the European Union and NATO and everything else is they understand that they're now close to checkmated, and their only option then is to flip the game board. All the way back to something when I spoke at the Ron Paul Institute and trying to describe the great game of geopolitics, and I described it as a 7-player game of Go, and I looked at everything that these people were doing, and I'm like, well, what's their next move? You flip the game board, folks, and you start invoking the potential for nuclear war.
Tom Luongo, Cool Goats and Guns. Good afternoon, my friend. How are you?
I'm good, Andy. How you been?
You know, I've been really good. And it's a lot of it has been, I've been taking the news with a grain of salt so I don't get too, my anxiety doesn't go too high or too low. I'm just trying to filter out that. And that's why I'm having you on, really just to help me filter all of this. So really what's been in the news, and let's start with this. You got, you really got Trump, it seems like, against the Fed. Start working that out for me. How important is this? And my perspective really is, correct me if I'm wrong, the guy only has what, you know, less than a year left before he hires a new one. Would it make even sense would fire him? And why would he fire him, I guess?
We'll start there. Okay, so first things first, all the news that's coming out today, you need more than a grain of salt. I would recommend a big shaker of like smoked sea salt that you grind, liberally spread all over every headline. But that being said, and especially when it comes to Powell, the Fed, Trump, and everything else. You're right. Powell's got what, 9 months left? He's gone in May. He's gone in May, right? He was, and so I've said this a little wrong in previous interviews, just to clarify. Powell was reconfirmed or was confirmed as Fed chair until confirmation by the FOMC, who's voted that, blessed that after his first term, after his previous term expired. He's winding up with an extra 3 months because of the process, but the process really is supposed to be the Fed chair serves a 4-year term, not any extra. And so this is a little weird because, you know, the Biden junta played so fast and loose with this reconfirmation in 2021, 2022. So Trump is clearly targeting, and Bessent have for the, since Scott Bessent, you know, entered the scene and kind of usurped Howard Lutnick's inside track for Treasury Secretary, you know, the Fed's role has been under attack. Slowly but surely, the Fed, the Trump administration has been making the argument that the Fed is a problem. Now, Jerome Powell is the head of the Federal Reserve, and he's also, in the words of Daniel DiMartino Booth, bureaucrat, ultimately, right? And he's many things, but he's also two things that I don't think we've ever seen before. One is that he's not an ivory tower intellectual. So he's not one of those PhDs on UBI, like Scott Bessent said the other day. And the second one is that he's an 8th-generation American. Okay? That doesn't trace his roots, you know, in recent times back to the old colonial family, the old, you know, banking clans of Europe.
And how important is that?
I think it's very important.
Point. What's that?
I think it's very important.
I do too. And I'm surprised and very happy you brought that up, because I think that's a key point. I want to lean on that here for a second here.
Sure. Let's talk about Scott Bessent and the same kind of guy. Remember when Trump, I noted
the details here, where you're about to go.
What I noted.
Here you go.
This is what I mean. This is like, when I noted that when he put Bessent forward as Treasury Secretary, about 2/3 of the way through that letter, he mentioned Scott's heritage, tracing back to the 1680s and the French Huguenots. Now, there's absolutely no reason why that should be there other than as a signal, oh, by the way, this guy's not a race trader any more than Jerome Powell is. Powell's a private equity guy who came from there. He's also a guy like Trump and like Bessent, is a self-made billionaire. He has absolutely zero reason to sit here and take the slings and arrows of the political swamp that is DC to do this second term. He had no reason to take on a second term other than wanting to finish the job that I think he started. Go back. I've talked about this 1,000 times, but let's, you know, put the primitives on the table again to understand where we are. Powell was always a hawk, going back to the days when Daniel Booth was at the Fed working for Richard Fisher. And it was Powell and Fisher and a few others were the ones that were like calling bullshit on Bernanke's 2% inflation target. And where did this come from? And, you know, he was always a guy in the shadows saying, look, I don't agree with any of this, that what we're doing. But he wasn't in a position to do anything about it. Now, he was also, in many ways, a kind of, you know, unknown player at the Fed. So he wasn't anyone that would draw a political firestorm if he was nominated in his Fed chair. And I obviously, he was handed, you know, Trump didn't know anything about him. His former Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, and probably the other Wall Street guys around the first term said, this guy Powell's, you know, he's good. He's not going to rock the boat too hard. He is a hawk. He's not going to continue to do what Yellen's been doing. He'll be better. Now, Trump, of course, is, you know, he's still at heart a shitbag property developer from Queens who likes low interest rates in order to develop property. And he just thinks he's better at it than everybody else. And he has a better plan than everybody else. And so he likes low interest rates in order to do big infrastructure projects. And, you know, basic Austrian business cycle theory tells you, you know, they're the most interest rate sensitive. So, of course, he wants low interest rates for these projects. And he's grandiose and he's got a big historical focused persona and all the rest of this stuff. And he wants to be, you know, known as the greatest president who ever lived and all of this stuff. But at its core is this idea that he does have, he understands that what needs to be done to rebuild America. So he and Powell were always going to be at loggerheads anyway, because Powell's going to be a hawk going, we can't continue to roll over to the offshore Eurodollar system and, you know, hamstring Fed monetary policy by having these people dictate our policy to us, which is what happens when we're at the zero bound and we can allow it to grow far faster and far greater at a far greater rate than the domestic market can, especially since the domestic markets have been bound down with Dodd-Frank and all those other terrible, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank and all of these things that have bound down the American banks to make them less competitive or make them less competitive, still more competitive than European banks or other banks, but less competitive than they would be normally. And that's the world we've been living in. And that's to rebalance the field globally in this kind of, you know, classic kind of communist socialist, hey, let's make everybody equal and make everybody equally shitty. If the European banks were all zombies and been bailed out 1,000 times by Mario Draghi and Christine Lagarde and everybody else, well, the Fed needs to be there to backstop all of that. And that's mostly the story of Bernanke and Yellen. They didn't have either, in Bernanke's case, he didn't have the backbone to let them all go bankrupt in 2008 because he was an academic. And in the case of Yellen, I always thought she was a card-carrying commie. Okay? Like, yes. You know, and that's a simple, I think it's just, it dives into that. Powell was always cut from a different cloth. So he and Trump were at loggerheads during Trump's first term. And then they are at loggerheads in the beginning of the second term. In the first term, though, Powell was absolutely the right guy for the job because Trump was never going to get the things put in place that would allow for us to express what needed to be done at that moment in time. We didn't have SOFR in place. We didn't have, Trump was never going to get tariffs through. He was never going to get anything done with that Congress. And surrounded by the neocons and the deep staters and everything else, he was being bound down by all these Lilliputians and they destroyed his presidency. And even then, he was still mostly successful to the point where he and Powell both needed to be destroyed. And that's where they gave us COVID. among other reasons why they gave us COVID, was to destroy the shift away from LIBOR, or at the very least, if we were going to shift off onto SOFR, it would still be controlled effectively in, you know, in the, through the back door, through banking regulation and and everything else. And so that once it went fully in place by 2022, you know, the American fiscal position would be so bad that the Fed would never be able to get off the zero bound, thereby obviating any benefit that SOFR would confer to us. That's my framework. You can,
yes,
you can feel free to disagree with me on this, folks. I don't give a shit, but I know that I'm right about this at this point, because it's okay, pretty freaking obvious by the way the American economy has survived Powell going from 0 to 5.5% in a year, and then holding it at 4.5% and holding it there for a year, and then going down to 4.5% quickly and holding it there for a year. And we're in good shape relative to the rest of the world. And if it wasn't for the fact that we were in good shape right now, and yes, there are problems and there are cracks forming and blah, 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 blah. And I'm not saying that the U.S. economy is great from any rational perspective. I'm talking about purely from the current framework's perspective. We are by far the least dirty shirt in the laundry. Yeah, the laundry stinks to high heaven, but it ain't our fault. Okay. Yeah. Everybody else is worse off than we are. So that's where.
Let me interrupt you, because I first had you on, I don't know how long ago, 18 months ago. You said something to me that I'll never forget. And I want to work this out in a bigger, even a bigger context. You told me that the Fed is in a really interesting position, and you're alluding to a good position at the time. And first time I've heard that, and you were right. But I, what you just said too, layering on 2 minutes ago, exactly, relative to everybody else, I think we're in a fantastic position. And I don't think the restoration or the continued restoration could be happening. And that's what we're somewhat talking about, without Powell doing what he did, meaning jacking up interest rates as he did.
Yes. Not only jacking up interest rates, but shrinking the Fed's balance sheet to pre-COVID levels.
Yes. Yes.
Massive, massive, massive thing. And in the process, of course, what was that going to do? And this is an important thing, because it's part of the talking points that are being used against Powell now. One, it would force the rest of the world into a decision. Are you going to allow the rates to rise fully to go along with us or not? And if you are, then you have to engage in yield curve control before we do. We don't have to engage in yield curve control. Now, Yellen tried doing it at Treasury, because that's kind of her middle name, Janet Yield Curve Control Yellen. But Lagarde, within 5 months of the first rate hike, had to start doing yield curve control. And she's been doing it ever since. And when you check the tick data, as I've talked about many, many times, it's clear that Europe across the board has been gorging on U.S. treasuries. Now, what has that done? Well, of course, what it's done is it's allowed, it's continued to allow Europe to, in effect, be capitalized by the interest they're getting paid on these bonds that they bought at 4.5% and 5%. No argument there. There's no way to avoid that. If you want to drain the leverage from the system, someone's going to get paid. Now the question, right, that's, and so, yeah, we're paying out a ridiculous amount of money in interest to European banks and to European central banks, right? And to other central banks as well. But hey, that's the problem you have of, but that's not Jerome Powell's fault. Then the Biden junta could have cut spending and allowed Powell to raise interest rates. And then it would have been, we would have raised interest rates, but they wouldn't have been sending $1.7 trillion worth of treasuries overseas to, you know, to deal with this problem. And you wouldn't see the euro at $1.17. No, they would have been doing this, but the euro would be at $1.04 or 90 cents. And all the things that Martin Armstrong and I have been talking about, how the euro should be collapsing, but it refuses to. And it refuses to collapse because there's still this trade, structural trade deficit that we have with Europe that's been used to funnel the buying of all these treasuries. So we never fixed that. We were never going to fix that if we didn't get the fiscal position under control. Now Trump is starting to fix the fiscal side of things. And I'm sorry to anybody, any critic in the audience who's listening, going, I haven't fixed anything. We still have this massive deficit. Like, dude, we're going to bring in $300 billion this year in tariffs. There's $300 billion off the marginal flow of marginal treasury issuance that's off the table. Mm-hmm. The treasury is clearly spending less money than was budgeted under 2025 under Biden, because mm-hmm. the treasury keeps going out every quarter and saying, we need to issue less debt than we had originally planned for. They've done this two quarters in a row. The last number that came out of Bessent was that in June, we spent $200 billion less than we spent in May. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's a lot of money. So I never said during all the years that I was talking about there's a path out of this for us, right? Mm-hmm. What it means that what I meant, I kept saying over and over again, and everybody kept like overstating what I was saying. I said, there's a path out, but all that you need to understand is that if we show the world that we're serious about getting our fiscal house in order and changing the way we do business, because we're still the least dirty shirt in the laundry, mm-hmm. and the best destination for capital with the best consumer class and the best credit and deepest, like, you know, bond and equity and credit markets and the best legal system for developing businesses. Because remember, to everybody else, we're the offshore tax haven.
Right.
Okay. So put all that in your hopper and fucking smoke it. And what do you get? You get that global capital will be the freaking path to our door if we just stop acting like retards. So we're not acting like retards anymore. And what a shock.
Right.
People are willing to invest here in the United States. So let's one more thing. One last thing. So now, during all of that, what are the tariffs really doing? Why have the tariffs not been inflationary? Well, there's two good reasons. And the one is that the one that everybody missed, including myself, for forever and a day. Tariffs don't print more money.
All right.
Okay. Right. Let's start there. Tariffs don't print. Daniel Locke, I think, said this the other day. He's like, or is Peter St. Ange, one or the other. I was watching. There's very few people I actually listen to anymore because everybody else is literally a hair lit on fire, gaslit by morons. I can't listen to most people anymore. I listen to a handful of people, and everybody else is just, they've lost their friggin' minds, man. And I'm like, either he or Peter St. Ange said, look, tariffs aren't inflationary because you don't print more money. If anything, what you're doing is you're extracting back. Mm-hmm. You're saying I used this example the other day. All these businesses overseas were running far higher gross margins than their business deserved. Yeah. Because, you know, they're in the knockoff Nike sneaker business out of India or China. Mm-hmm. And they're running 45 and 50% gross margin. Excuse me. Nike gets to run 50% gross margins because they're the ones developing the sneakers. You guys should be running 8% margins because you're the knockoff brand.
Right.
But the combination of ruinous fiscal policy, cheap money, low interest rates, and an unfair tariff protection scheme allowed for these people to be making a crap ton of money hand over fist. And all Trump has done is goes, you know what? No. How about no? And we're gonna pull your margin. We're gonna claw back those unearned margins that we need to get back to that moment where, yeah, the knockoff Nike sneaker brand out of China with an unpronounceable name that you can buy on Amazon is no longer gonna be $30 less than the Nike brand that they make in the same goddamn factory with the same damn people. Mm-hmm. Well,
right.
So no, you're going to get 8% and we're going to get, and we're, you know, your gross margins are going to drop from 50% or 60% back down to 12% or whatever the hell it is.
Right.
And we're capturing the rest of that. And that's the second reason tariffs aren't inflationary. It proved to the world, and he's proven it already, that the world was making money on our dime. Mm-hmm. And the only reason these margins were allowed was because of the ridiculous amount of money being sent overseas through ruinous spending of the federal government. And the easiest way, of course, to get rid of, ruinous spending in the U.S., because remember, even if all of that money doesn't necessarily go straight out the door, it's not like we spend $1.7 trillion more than we take in and that money all winds up overseas directly. No, it goes to pay the salaries of the people living in Loudoun County doing nothing but shuffle paper around and obstruct the freaking president making 220 grand a year. It's paying all these middle managers at these companies, these white collar jobs, pushing paper around and acting like Bill Lumberg from freaking Office Space, you know, and adding zero value to the economy while he just while he checks up on, you know, whether or not the bullshit's going to from overseas is going to make it here on time. That's all he's got to do. He checks his watch twice a month, checks in with his underlings, and then and pulls out, you know, six figures.
Right.
Or more. And then he's got a mortgage with a $500,000 house and the whole, you know, and everything just inflates high heaven. And all that money, and then that money goes overseas. And their kids get to go to overpriced colleges and they get to, you know, buy overpriced cars and they get to buy and they get to live in overpriced McMansions in suburbia with the, you know, and that's what it, and they're paying, you know, vet bills that are for their fucking frou-frou dog for, you know, I mean, you know, I, you know, have you been to the vet recently? It's insane.
Yeah.
And like I have four dogs and every day, every time we, you know, they don't cost us very much, but every time one of the dogs like gets, has a problem, I'm like, oh, there's $400 going out the door.
Right. Easy.
For what should cost me 20. But my point being is that money goes out, comes, and now all we're doing is saying, you know, nuts to that. The money's staying here. Or it can go out, but it's coming back. And we're going to call that money back and we're going to use it to stop issuing more debt. And the proof is one, lack of inflation, and two, treasury auction after treasury auction after treasury auction, which goes out and looks like the United States is like hitting on all cylinders. Did you see the 20-year auction from this morning? Posted it up on my Twitter feed this morning. A lot of people out there saying a whole lot of bullshit about how bad U.S. Treasury demand for U.S. Treasuries are. And I'm like, I keep looking at the treasury auction numbers and I'm like, those look great. Even Zero Hedge is like, shit, 20-year auction going out with a bid to cover of 2.7 and at 2 basis points under the win issue. And I'm like, fuck off. Like there's absolutely nothing wrong with our treasury market. And, you know, I spar with Dave Collum about this stuff every time we get on a podcast together. And I'm like, Dave, I don't care that you're not willing to buy a 30-year treasury bond for anything less than double-digit interest. The rest of the world is.
Somebody is.
Somebody's there doing it. And it doesn't matter. And the thing is that over time, and again, no offense to Dave, because I love Dave. And I love sparring with Dave on this particular issue. But he's not here to defend himself, so I get to like make the point clearly. And happy to do it. So my point is that you can strip out that premia, right? It should be, you know, 30-year bonds should be 11%. They're trading at 5. You can strip that out over time by fixing the wage situation, fixing the fiscal situation, and then going through a period of stagflation effectively, you know, to deal with the problem. And you're going to have commodity inflation rising. You're going to have commodity inflation as you start the process of getting towards a demand pull environment, and you're going to have credit asset either stagnation or collapse contraction. Yeah. Or if you're going to do what I think Trump is trying to do, which is just basically freeze housing prices where they are and change the underlying Main Street economy to be able to support that for the younger generations, which is what I think he's trying to do. And I think that's what he and Bessent are trying to do. And Powell's job is to be the bad guy in all of this because Trump needs a villain.
Yeah. So he's the fall guy.
He's the scapegoat.
Yeah.
So I'm going to tie all this into, again, this, I'm just going back to other conversations we had, and you mentioned on this show, on my show, about money flow coming back to the U.S. This was about, I don't want to say 9 months ago.
Right.
And that's what's happening. And I was surprised at the time. And you've changed my opinion. You changed my opinion pretty quickly. I was like, I bet he's right. Money's going to flow. And that's what you're saying. Now, it's a very interesting position because you have money flow coming back to the U.S., higher interest rates, but the Fed, they're going to lower, right?
At some point, yeah. They might even lower next week.
Right. I think they will. But they can, right?
Yeah. Well, that's what everybody keeps saying. They can't, but they can. Here's the thing.
That's exactly it. Exactly. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, what I'm going to say is the following. And let's start with the first thing I'm going to say, which is, has anybody noticed that Jerome Powell is not hand-holding the markets anymore? Now, he did a lot of hand-holding for a long, long time. Now, the way I described it to my patrons literally this morning for the Wednesday market report was price discovery is coming back into the markets. It's going to be slow and painful. It's happening across all the domains, not just financial markets, not just commodity markets, not just, you know, rent and you know, and all that. No, it's also happening in the political markets, in the geopolitical markets, in the information space. It's happening everywhere. We're beginning to find out who's been full of shit and who hasn't been. And what does it actually cost to run a propaganda campaign against the president? What's it like to run how much is it really going to cost Iran to run a propaganda campaign about how powerful their missile systems are? Or Israel, conversely, effective Israel's Iron Dome system is, or. All of this stuff is now being found. We're going to find out about. We're beginning to find out who's been lying, who hasn't been. What we're really finding out is that everybody's been lying just a little bit because that's to their strategic advantage. But
right.
Some people are lying more than others, and that's the problem. And that's the problem we're having resolving. I'm getting my point. I'm going to get back to the point about Powell here in a second, but just understand across all these domains that we're seeing this, right? And it's affected our political conversations. You have high profile people who should know better falling for this shit left, right, and center. People like Tucker Carlson, right? You have other people who have wormed their way into becoming a trusted voice in the scenario in you know, say geopolitics, for example, who over the last 3 years have become vectors for bad information because they don't have the ability to really figure out when they're being lied to by intelligence agencies. And I'm not just saying they're inherently distrustful, for example, of anything we say, but they take everything the Russians say at face value. Like, really? You don't think Russians lie? I mean, I have a soft spot for the Russians. I love what they've done. They're farther along the process of extricating themselves from this globalist, you know, minority report with more Germans bullshit that we're seeing coming out of the European Union. But at the same time, it's not like they haven't been lying to us about stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, come on. So the truth, as always, lies somewhere in the middle between their propaganda, our propaganda, our willingness, and then us in the middle being willing to believe whatever narrative suits our personal psychological makeup at the time. And a lot of Americans who have become staunch critics of America for good in reason, because we've come something that we're not happy with, made us really susceptible. I think all of us, including myself for a long period of time. I'm not sitting here in a glass house, not throwing stones here. Like, you know, seriously, we all do this and we're all susceptible to someone else's propaganda. And so those lies are all coming down and we're getting real. I mean, I don't know about you, but I was just as surprised as anybody else at the 12-day war. I really thought Iran had more come, and they did. And yeah. a lot of people are having a hard time reconciling with that. And the outs, and you know, as the last aside before I get back to Powell, notice how both sides are trying to gin up the conflict again.
Yeah.
Whose MO is that? The right. Same MO as the people that are attacking are happily piling onto Trump's criticisms of Jerome Powell. How about Monday? I'll give you a perfect example. How about Monday? I walk away from my Twitter feed for like 5 hours after markets close on Monday because I'm like, dude, Mr. Pandora Classic is dropping. I'm playing WoW tonight. I don't want to deal with this bullshit. And I come back and I wake up the next morning and everybody's talking about, oh, Powell's going to have a speech this morning at 8:30. He's going to resign. I'm like, where the fuck did that come from?
Right.
And I'm like, well, he never does things like that. Blah, 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 and Bissett was there yesterday. And everybody was like, really? You think Jerome Powell is going to like fold that easily to Orange Jesus? And if he does, you don't think that that's not all part of that goddamn kayfabe anyway?
Yeah.
And what does he do? He gets out and he gives a speech, you know, talking about how we have to reform things. And, you know, everybody's like, we got Anna Paulina Stripper referring him to criminal, referral to the DOJ over, you know, a 31% cost overrun on the Fed remodeling. I'm like, really? Only 31%? I'm like, that by government standards, a 31% cost overrun is coming in under budget.
Yeah, right.
For fuck's sake. Like, really? So that one doesn't have, so she's just, you know, AOC with better curves and, you know, and a concealed carry permit being run by somebody who, you know, being run by, for her own purposes, by somebody who's trying to pile on. I wonder who the hell she works for or does it or is being fed bad information. Like, it's dumb. The point of all of this is to play this up. Again, all roads lead to London, folks, because they're the ones who are in the most vulnerable position here.
Yes.
Period. Okay. Around everything that's happening. So that's what's happening with, so Powell being set up as the bad guy. Now to the original question about strategic ambiguity. Let's the last point, and then I'll turn the microphone back over. Which is because I need to actually answer the question you were getting at. But
go ahead.
So, which is, like I said, has anybody noticed Jerome Powell is now actually not spoon feeding the markets anymore? The bond markets as of this morning are like bored. Like, yeah, Powell's not going to cut rates. 3 weeks ago at the beginning of the month, I was told Chris Marcus, I'm like, I could see Powell cutting 50 basis points just to make Trump happy.
Okay.
That was then. Then we got a trade deal with Japan. Then we got a trade deal with Indonesia, then Vietnam, and da-da-da. We got the big ones. Indonesia, Vietnam, Japan. These are big ones. These are important ones because they're also the way that, you know, Chinese goods get rebranded. They go through Indonesia, they go through Vietnam, they go through Malaysia, they go through Laos and all these other countries. But he gets all that done, more data comes out, but the data is like the data is non-committal. Like the CPI data is not great. The core PCI, the PC deflator data is not all that interesting. The labor market data is decent, right? I mean, decent. The housing market data is not great. Yeah. The big home builders got crushed last quarter. Yeah. They're down 24%. Yeah. Year over year. Yeah, what a shock. You guys built shitty houses for too much money.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to say it. Bill Pulte and D.R. Horton and Lennar and all that, they built crappy cookie cutter houses for too much money, and they can't get that money anymore. So, yeah, they've got a problem. You bet on something that wasn't going to happen, and, you know, you bet on 7 interest rate cuts last year. You only got 4, and now you're in trouble, and now you're screaming. Yeah. Pulte over at FH, you know, over FHFA he's got a job to do. And I know what that job is. And I'm not worried about him running his mouth in public because he only does what he's told to do. But you know, that's my take on the subject. I may be wrong, but, you know, Powell could cut 25 basis points here and surprise the shit out of the market and just shock everybody out of their complacency. They go, you know what? Nah, yeah, we can cut 25 basis points. I can make Trump happy. I can back some pressure off the Fed, whatever, and I can throw 25 basis points into the hopper and watch everybody lose their minds. Dow's kicking up towards 45 grand, trying to break out to an all-time high. The German DAX is struggling to break to new all-time highs, which makes sense because where else was anybody going to put the money when they're doing massive amounts of financial repression in the bond market in Europe? But the French markets are rolling over. The Italian markets are on fire, by the way. I don't know if anybody's noticed. Right.
Yeah.
Which is important because they're the only ones that actually, you know, mean anything, which is what do you think the ECB wants to get their digital euro in place and, you know, run the table on everybody and in the next 4 or 5 months? It's because the Italians are getting ready to, you know,
I want to talk about that too.
But so there we are. And I could see Powell cutting. I could see Powell not cutting. I could see Powell going, shocking everybody with 50. Like, he could do any one of those things, and they would all be the right thing to do for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is no one thing going on here. But whatever he does next week will be a signal as to what's coming down, why he's doing it. If he doesn't cut, it's because he doesn't think he's got Europe on their knees yet. If he does cut, it means that he can play that game and alleviate the stress in the credit markets and open things up politically here and shock the markets a little bit and get them to start doing some real price discovery. If he cuts by 50, it's because there's a fucking problem somewhere deep in the plumbing domestically, and he's worried. Yeah. I think 50 is way off the table. I think 25 could mean one thing, and I think zero means not something completely different. That's what I think. And you know, salt it and yeah, get out that big salt shaker. I prefer the, you know, the smoked Himalayan sea salt. Do that, you know, put it over your steak.
Okay. So many key points here. First, I want to give a shout out 5 minutes ago. And I mean this, like, Tom, dude, you give so much insight and it's very stimulating.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'll just leave it at that. It's very stimulating to me. And I have a list of questions, but I want to keep it flowing. I just want to shout out to Alex Craner because you brought up Iran. Mm-hmm. You brought up Iran and where did that all go? And Alex, I had him on when that was hitting the fan. And just all the viewers and listeners, find that video. It was the latest I did with Alex, just about, is he out of his mind? And then, is Trump out of his mind? No, I don't think so. And literally the next day, there was... And right. It goes, I guess, with the idea and the thesis of these are 40 moves, if you would. We're playing a game, if you would. It's not what you think. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's a lot of thought behind all of this. Second thing is this goes back to the very original point in this conversation. It's very important, the idea that Powell and Bessett don't have any European connections. And I think what you just said just tied all again with Italy. And I want to pull on that, and I want to work in crypto.
Mm-hmm.
I said that
because I just had.
Oh, now do we have 4 hours? Because I don't. I have like too much work today. But
well, I'm becoming a believer because they wanted, again, an ECB digital coin. The U.S. the Fed will come out with the digital coin.
The Fed doesn't want a central bank digital currency. They want plumbing. They want a plumbing rail on the back end, right? Digital. So again, SWIFT is the next thing to discuss here. Before we go into that, a shout out as always to my good friend Alex Craner about.
And you gave me Alex. By the way,
he's a tremendous, great mind,
very clever. He's become a friend of mine. He's become a friend.
Really, truly, truly great. And even when he, and the best part about Alex is that, of course, is that, you know, when he's missed something or when he's not, you know, he goes, he like immediately recalculates in real time and then goes, oh yeah. And then, you know,
it's a great character trait, by the way. Yeah.
Which is yep. Agreed. And,
calibrate. Yeah. Go ahead.
The ability to do that. And, so
we have the same states, London, all of that. God. Yeah. Good luck.
Yeah. So what I gotta leave the crypto stuff off for a second because that's just, that's more treasury stuff, but it's okay. Also, this is about rapidly depreciating assets. The old world is going away. The world we've known our entire lives is going away. It doesn't exist. It almost doesn't exist.
What you just said is going to be my.
So what I mean by rapidly depreciating assets, I mean everything. Iran's nuclear program, Israel's quest for greater Israel, and Ukraine as a
domestic, you know, politics.
Woke DEI, climate change, SWIFT, the old Forex markets, like all those old connections, all those old systems, they're all going away. Why? Because technology is an expression of human need. And when technology and when humans go, this system sucks and I don't like it and I want something different, I'm going to go build something that works better. And I'm going to try a lot of different versions of this until one works, until we get one right. And the entrenched systems, classically, the horseshoe makers and the wagon wheel makers were pissed off with Henry Ford, right? Same, that's the classic one. Well, got news for you. Payment systems and payment chains and, you know, the infrastructure of who controls politically controls how money moves around the world is also subject to the same problem. And the people who are trying to hold on to that. And this is where a lot of people in our space, you know, get the basics right. That old system's failing. And of course, you know, the Austrians will say, we have to go back to gold, and someone else will say, well, you know, and no, we're not ever going back to gold in a direct settlement system because we can't. So,
right.
And we can't because gold does not allow for the resolution that we can move gold coins in our, you know, pockets and then hand them out to go buy shit at the store. I'm sorry, but I, you know, a 20th ounce gold coin is going to buy you an awful lot of dinner,
mm-hmm.
You know? And then how do you break that up and pay the waitress? And how do you break that up and pay the busboy and, you know, pay so, I mean, it doesn't work. Right. So SWIFT, I think back on it now, I remember back to when I used to be a disciple of Jim Sinclair's, you know, God's rest his soul, said that, you know, Obama using SWIFT to shake down UBS in 2010 was the going nuclear moment, because that's the ultimate tool to enforce financial orthodoxy. Sanctions are not nearly as, but you SWIFT expulsion and all of a sudden you don't have the ability to do business now. And Jim was like, that's it. Balloon's going up. And he's right. It was a watershed moment. But if you think back on it now, and I've been thinking about this recently, and I've been like thinking about that in 2010 all the way to today, and then less than 2 years later, Iran is kicked out of the SWIFT system. That's 18 months later, like June 2010, the Swiss are threatened. 18 months later, in December of 2011, we formally SWIFT votes to kick Iran out of the system. Eventually, we kick the Russians out. Right? Why? Well, it's because over time, the minute you do it, it winds up being, that's the peak of Swiss power. Yeah. But was it really? Or was it, we can see the end of SWIFT over the horizon and it's beginning to lose value as a tool to enforce orthodoxy. And therefore it was peaked, and now they're going to start using it. Because other systems don't, because other forms of leverage, and I mean that with, you know, in the mob sense of the word leverage, baseball bat and a kind word kind of thing, than, you know, financial leverage. So that's, I think Swift is done. I'm sorry. Yeah. I watch one 15 to 20 minute video on the Ripple network, and I'm like, there's the end of Swift. There's the end of Thomas Cook. There's the end of the British pound, blah, 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 blah. Is it perfect? No. Well, the Bitcoiners like start all tune out of this podcast immediately because I mentioned the word Ripple. Yes. And sorry, dudes, you're missing it. Like, I'm not saying that, you know, you're going to have to, Bitcoin now has to compete for payment reps. And maybe, yes, in the future, we're this, any stopgap system that we put in place now using replacing Swift with something else, Ripple, this one, that one. I don't give a shit what it is. I'm completely agnostic on this stuff. I just bring it up because I'm looking at it going, clear, the Trump administration is picking XRP. Okay. So, and there's a lot of people out there who just hate the United States so much that they don't, that whatever the United States picks must be evil.
Yeah.
But every day is opposite day in Trump's new America because that hasn't changed. So I think Swift is a rapidly depreciating asset. I think all the congressmen and senators that are above the age of, you know, 68 or 70, they're all rapidly depreciating assets. They need to be used for as many votes as to block as many votes as possible. Like Jeffrey Epstein, clearly a rapidly depreciating asset. Like, again, Iran-Israel conflict, it's a rapidly depreciating asset. Hamas, I said it on 10-8, for fuck's sake. Hamas was a rapidly depreciating asset. Someone, whoever was running that version of Hamas that attacked Israel on 10-7, use it or lose it moment, folks. So many things around our old world, okay, is there. And I'll be honest with you, the story of, and the fairy tale of, quote unquote, that's also a rapidly depreciating asset that needs to be used for the maximum amount of value that it can get. And of course, it ties into Epstein, and it ties into Iran Israel, and it ties into this, and it ties into that. And again, you know, not saying the Israelis aren't, you know, committing war crimes now in Gaza. Not saying that. I was very skeptical of where things were in the first 60 days, 60 to 90 days after 10-7. Because the rhetoric and the propaganda was so fucking off the charts.
Yeah. Right?
Doesn't matter that what I thought 18 months ago, whatever. Like, yeah, no, they're still doing that. No, now it's fucking ridiculous. But again, Israel, is it a rapidly depreciating asset for whoever created it in the first place?
Great point.
Okay. I, you know, I've got to ask that question all the time. This is I am not putting forth my personal opinion about the morality of any of this shit. Mm-hmm. It's not my job to give you my morality. It isn't. I'm not running cover for anyone. Okay. If I'm running cover for anybody, I'm running cover for Trump. Not because Trump is an agent of the Israelis, because I think Trump is trying to take down, restore the Commonwealth. Because I think he's I think he's a true royalist, if you want my honest opinion. And I've always thought that about Trump. I've always thought that Trump had a real soft spot for the real British crown. Not the, as my friend Ian Burlingame would put it, not the fake one that's been sitting on the throne since 1688. Like, you know, this is a big deal, folks. And if you watch what's happening since Trump started targeting Keir Starmer, and he did that in the middle of the transition period.
Yep.
That's what clued me in that maybe my passing thought that maybe Trump is going to do something about this turned into, holy shit, he's actually going to do it.
Yeah.
Blindsided me. I have he gets this shit. Oh my God. But you know why he gets it? He gets it because he's trying, because he's tracing back Russiagate.
Yeah. So that goes back again to our original question about, or original point about how it, no old world European ties, if you would. Very interesting. Another thing, though, I think we've been given a cue or a clue here. America being the crypto capital or the crypto center of the world. Think about that. And that has to, it goes into your hypothesis of depreciating assets of all the old systems, SWIFT, et cetera.
LIBOR, this, that.
Et cetera, right? So let's point to then the former oligarchs, I should say the current oligarchs, and I'm talking about the EU oligarchs,
right.
The systems, or the people in power over there. This is crumbling, and as we've seen, work that out for me. Where are we at? And Trump can certainly take a punch here because he's been taking
taking a punch in the mouth, and he's clearly, the full court press is on to try and marginalize him and kill his presidency before it's even gotten started, right? But the bigger question that I have is, again, go back to things I've talked about in the past, which is, who's in control of the escalatory ladder? You know, what is the escalatory, what ladder are we talking about, and who's in control of that ladder? And what I see out of the European Union and NATO and everything else is they understand that they're now close to checkmated, and their only option then is to flip the game board. We're all the way back to something when I spoke at the Ron Paul Institute and trying to describe the great game of geopolitics. And I described it as a 7-player game of Go. And I looked at everything that these people were doing. And I'm like, well, what's their next move? You flip the game board, folks. Then you start invoking the potential for nuclear war.
Right.
Now we got Martin Armstrong out there saying, look, this is where I think this goes.
Right.
And
he just came out with that recently.
Yeah, he just came out with it the other day. I'm going to speak to Marty in a little over, I think, about a week and a half. I've got him for the podcast towards the end of the month, And I hope Martin's wrong about that. And, you know, I also hope that, I also hope that if NATO does move into Ukraine with a large number of troops, none of which are Americans, by the way, but how are they going to push 250,000 troops into Ukraine without some American assets being on the table? And then the big question that everybody should be asking themselves is, how do the Russians respond to that?
Yeah.
What if the Russians really don't have air superiority? What if the S-500s aren't that good? I mean, I'm dead serious, folks. Like, I'm not asking that question because I want to be I want to believe that the Russians are in trouble. I don't want to believe that they're in trouble. I want to believe that they're in control of the situation, because that actually is best for humanity,
yeah.
Right? Like, what's best for humanity is that NATO goes in there and gets puts those troops in and gets their ass handed to them and can't establish air superiority, and they can't establish air superiority over the Russians.
That is the question. What if they can?
And what if they can? What if we've all been gaslit into believing that America's ability to fight a war isn't as bad as we think it is. Again, is that Russian propaganda that you're listening to? Is that Iranian propaganda? Is it Chinese propaganda? Hell, is it British propaganda? Now, I was chatting with Larry Johnson, called me the other day. And we were chatting on the phone about this, and we were talking about these very things. And I said, and to Larry's consistent point, he says, yeah, we can fight that war, Tom. I'm not going to disagree with you, but we can't do it for very long. We don't have the kind of depth necessary to fight protracted conflict that way. And now that, you know, in many ways, this is now drone conflicts, you know, this is a drone war, you know, you start asking yourself the question, are nuclear weapons themselves the ultimate depreciating asset? Because we don't need nuclear weapons to blackmail countries into submission over threatening millions and their civilian population.
Right.
We have missing technology. And this is a point that Alex put into my head the last time he and I sparred, and we were sparring over Iran and Israel and all this stuff. We were sparring. It was, you know, one of the rare times when Alex and I were really not at loggerheads, but, you know, we were sparring, and it was a good spar. And he said, but Tom, we're now moving into drone war and missile wars where the accuracy of these weapons is so high, we don't need to target civilian operations, civilian centers anymore. We can literally just fight strategic targets and bomb them from or drone swarm them and not hit anything else. And we have a lot of data that suggests that that Iran was able to pull that off with whatever they were able to throw at Israel. They targeted the Mossad headquarters, this research facility, that military position, that port, blah, 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 blah. And did minimal civilian casualties. What did the Israelis do? They walked in with a whole bunch of planes. They did combined arms operations on the ground to knock out air defenses, knock out missile launchers, and then established, you know, air superiority and flew cap over Tehran for a week and a half, and then just kept bombing all the launchers that Iran would shoot, you know, would shoot a missile off, hits their target in Israel, in Tel Aviv, and then that launcher was gone. This is why we saw 200 missiles the first night, 100 the next night, 50 the next night, 15, 10, blah, until the war was over.
Right.
Which, from humanity's perspective, is fantastic because these guys beat the crap out of each other. And the war was... Civilian casualties are minimum, and the potential for a protracted conflict is now zero.
Right. Talk about a short
path. That's what's important. And the same, and so now let's apply that model potentially to Ukraine at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I ask these questions not because I have an opinion one way or the other, because I'm literally saying to you, and I need you to believe, and I need the audience to believe, you don't know nearly as much as you think you fucking know. So stop trying LARPing as somebody who knows what's going on, and instead react to the data that's you do get and what that implies, and then recalculate the state of play. Because that's all you can do. Because
that's all you can do.
Making these decisions have more information than you do.
Yeah.
And there's nobody out there with good information, because the Russians aren't leaking out what's really happening anymore to guys like Larry Wilkerson or Doug McGregor or Larry Johnson or myself or anyone else. Sorry, folks, not. Because if they are, then they're really in trouble. Then that implies something really bad.
Mm-hmm.
They're in serious fucking trouble if they're having to play that game. Yeah. And we're not doing it either.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the bigger question is, when you start watching the way the information gets leaked out and who's leaking it and why, and then we get into all that stuff. And at this point, we've so polluted the information space that everybody just wants a simple, stupid answer about everything. Yeah. That if you say any of that, and you're going to get comments on this video right below. I know you are. You guys are typing them right now. That Luongo is just engaging 15D chess again. Like, no, I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you, this is the way the shit works. And 15D chess is the new conspiracy theory. It's the thing you put out there to rob you of your reason. And now you've become the guy who screams conspiracy theory on the left for every time that that Trump and company uncovered a layer of the Russiagate conspiracy 6, 7, 8 years ago. And the left was all, and you know, Mark Hamill's like a conspiracy theory, and is all being fed by the fucking intelligence services on both sides. And you guys have been turned into that. And if you like being there, great. But I don't. I want to understand what's actually happening to the best of my ability, talking out in the public space, and you know, point
change
people
to mind
information.
Yeah, change my mind then. You know, And also, I'd like,
and again, I'm open to all of these things, and maybe I don't know nearly as much as, or I know even less than I think I do. Maybe that's true, but I'm not making that argument at this point because at the moment when the missiles start flying, mm-hmm. it will be too late, and no one will give a shit whether you were right or wrong. By the way. And if you are so damn right, if you are so convinced that you're right, why are you wasting your time on Twitter yelling at me about it and not laying in hand sardines, toilet paper, blah, 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 and getting up into the fucking mountains where you can, you know, get a water source that's not going to be contaminated by the fallout?
Yeah. Another thing, too, I might add is be willing to change your mind with information, with information that you trust and has been vetted, and yourself and Alex are really good at that. And Martin Armstrong.
Marty's very good at it.
Really good at that. And that's really a sign of strength. I think Steve Jobs actually, rest in peace, he actually said the same thing. It's a sign of strength if you can change your, if you change your mind. So.
Let's talk about what I haven't changed my mind about, which is power. Yeah. Right. I refuse to, I'm going down with the ship on Powell here. Powell, any number of things could happen here. And the truth is that to go back all the way back to the beginning of this conversation, what's going on with the Fed? Clearly, Trump is getting ready to change the way the Fed operates. Bessent wants it to happen. Trump wants it to happen. Clearly, he wants a different system. And the Fed, as an institution in its current role in the global economy, with the rules and the powers that it has and the mandates that it has, only supports the old system. If you have a new system, you need to have a new role for the Fed. And so this is what's been like dominating my thinking for close to 2 years now. What does this all imply? Do we even need a Fed funds rate? I said that the day after I figured out what SOFR was. I'm like, well, this opens up the potential re-regionalization of the Fed funds rate. We don't even need the Fed funds rate anymore. SOFR can replace it. I asked that question to Daniel DiMartino Booth when I had her on my podcast in 2022. And she's like, yeah, but the banks will never give up that power. Of course it does, but they'll never give up that power. I'm like, okay, fair point. How do we get to the point where they will give up that power? I never asked that question, but that's the first question that pops into my head after I hear somebody, you know, I hear somebody like Danielle say something like that. I take that very seriously when she says it, and she's right, or she was right. So now the question is, right, what's that?
Is it fast forward to 2025?
Fast forward to 2025. Trump is in power for a second term. He's put tariffs on. He's talking about the External Revenue Service and doing away with the tax and spend. You know, central bank supported economic system. He wants to get rid of it, you know, but in the short term, and this is where you have to be careful of, you know, of who enters the scene, who's the new person, who's the new favorite person that enters the scene that is providing the received wisdom. And this is, again, it's not to throw shade on anybody. It is when you see somebody else come into the commentariat, and they have a good take on things, watch carefully for where they're interjecting their agenda versus the reality, what's actually happening. And the perfect example of this is in today's parlance is the two lovely old women from the Promethean Action Group, the downstream of LaRouche. And they're 90% of what they say is I absolutely agree with, but the fact that they're piling every chance that they can get to pile on Powell is just revelatory of their agenda, because they're not thinking in terms of how of the order of operations. And I'm like, clearly Powell's falling on a sword. He's not fighting for the city of London. If he was fighting for the city of London, we would never have gone out to zero fucking bound.
Right.
And anybody with like half a brain who's spent any time inside capital markets understands this very point. I got pushback 4 years ago about all this shit because no one expected that was too much of a rug pull and framework change for people to expect. And you go, yeah, but they'll never go through with that, Tom. Sounds great. And everybody said the same goddamn thing to me. Sounds great, but they'll never do it. And yet here we are. And
here we are.
We're starting to do it, or we are doing it. We're in the midst of doing it. And so, you know, again, not here, you know, patting myself on the back or tooting my own horn. Just saying, I put forth a hypothesis. I checked that hypothesis, and that hypothesis kept coming up smarter or more correct than the other ones that everybody was like, wow. Yeah, I guess you were right about that. I guess I was. And cool. But that doesn't mean anything. That was yesterday. We've got tomorrow to deal with. Tomorrow, we're always working towards what's tomorrow. And so at some point, Powell, higher for longer interest rate policy will become a rapidly depreciating asset. Yeah. And we're at that moment in time now.
Yeah.
You have to be willing to give up what you had and then use it to its maximal advantage for as long as possible, and then sacrifice it in order to get a move over here. Why do you think I play these fucking things?
I was about to play it out.
I guess it's right, all right there. And my alliance with you is a rapidly depreciating asset. Bye. See you. We're done. I'm making an alliance with those guys now. And that's what you do. And I don't understand why that's such a, I don't know. I don't understand why that's such a controversial way to look at the world.
No, it's not. It's not. And I think that's actually kind of how you have to look at the world. We'll end on this. We've gone on long enough, and I do have to leave at the bottom of the hour. But two things. One's a point and one final question. A point, when we talked about changing our minds, I had you on before the election and then right on after the election. Yes. And boy, did you change your mind. So there you go to all my audience and listeners. Things change. It's a game.
Things do change. And, you know, okay, here's one that I got wrong. Ready? I said before the election, I said, if Harris wins, Powell will hold rates higher for longer, as high as possible, for as long as possible, because he's going to have to try and sterilize and blackmail her into not doing ridiculous amounts of fiscal spending. And if Trump wins, he'll cut harder than he would have under Harris. Now, I did say, I have been, and I said at the beginning of the year, and every year I write a newsletter. I write the Apologia on the January issue, both for Newsmax's UWR, Ultimate Wealth Report, and for Gold, Goats, and Guns. I always do a, what did we get right? What did we get wrong? You know, sure. Got these things right. I got these things wrong. Let's talk about why those things happen. I said at the beginning of the year, I thought we're going to be closer to 3% at the end of this year than we would be to 4%, meaning we're going to be below 3.5% on the Fed funds rate. So far, coming up a cropper on that one. But at some point,
5 months.
But, you know, there's four more Fed meetings left, and he could easily cut 100 basis points between now and then.
Yeah.
And, or five more Fed meetings. He's got, one, two, three, four. He's got four left. He's got the second half of the year, July, September, November, Halloween, mid-December. Phil Dick's birthday, Tea Party Day. The 16th, generally, it's right around there. Middle of the second week in December, Halloween, you know, right after Labor Day, and next week. If he doesn't cut in July here, he's got a lot of work to do to get, you know, four or five on the board before the end of the year. But if he doesn't cut here, he's going to cut 50. He's got to cut 50 after Jackson Hole.
Yeah,
because at the very least, at that point, he's going to be setting the table for the next Fed chair, who is going to cut rates anyway. So why would he be a dick on the way out the door and not give Trump what he wants then? That's all we're dealing with here. Trump is in a position where he's trying to do as much as quickly as possible before he gets into the midterms. He wants the interest rates cut, to jack the economy up so that he can then sell the midterms, you know, and he understands the political time frame. At the same time, we've got the DOJ, the ODNI, the FBI, all that working on legal time, which is far slower than political time, which is the fastest of all of this, or second fastest. And then you got financial time. And from this monetary policy standpoint, you know, takes 6 months generally for a shift in monetary policy to be absorbed by the markets. So Trump is starting to run out of time and Powell doesn't start cutting rates. And if they got to go into this to September at 4.5%, it's going to do two things. One, it's going to really put the European Union in a bind, right? It's going to force them to either continue buying crap tons of U.S. treasuries, which, and you'll look at the long end of the yield curve, like it's getting really towards that time where Powell needs to cut. I mean, I'm not going to lie here, like, but you know, Europe is going to get something for a rate cut because he cuts and yields fall, then they're going to be able to sell into the fall and make money on the spread, right? They bought it five, they bought a 30 at 5%. They're going to sell it at 4.465. They're going to make 35 basis points. They're going to make shit pot of money on it. But, you know, it's a one-time thing and they've sold. But then again, those 5% coupon bonds, who are they going to get bought by? Don't care about who sold them. Care about who buys them. And what Trump is obviously setting up is for the American
us to buy them.
To buy them. And it comes back into the American banking system at that higher rate.
Money flowing back to the U.S.
Money comes back into the U.S.
We tied this all together. Maybe we leave on that, because I was going to give you one point to leave on, and maybe we leave on that. Tell me, did you have one point to tell the audience, one thing just to keep in mind until the next time I have you on?
Stay nimble and don't react to what's happening on a day-to-day basis. Every piece of news that comes out has a political agenda behind it. And you should wait 48 to 72 hours before you make any noise about it. I'm actually doing fewer podcasts on purpose.
Thank you. Thank you for doing mine.
Well, no, I part of for July was because I'm on vacation for 2 weeks and I only did like one or two while I was on vacation. But part of it is that I don't want to do as many of these because then I have to either repeat myself 17 times because I'm not going to like change my, because nothing's going to change in 3 days, or we have to wait for the new piece of information to funnel through.
Yeah.
So when you see a discordant piece of information, Tulsi Gabbard changing the rules of how the ODNI works, that you can react to in real time. Everything else, probably not nice until you find out 3 days later what it's actually worth.
Okay. Yeah. That's great advice. And that's actually on this beginning of this conversation where I don't engross myself with the news as much. And you said, hey, salt and pepper it on. Yes. But I mischaracterized or phrased that. I try not to react to the news because it's coming every day.
Coming every hour, Andy. It's
every hour.
And I'll be honest with you. I feel it, right? I'm not, you know, just the one last thing. I feel it. I feel the pressure of people want my opinion on things. And I appreciate that. I really do. I appreciate that people value my opinion. Like, dude, that's what I've worked for. And I think I've presented myself great. But sometimes I'm like, I can't react to that. And I get people asking me all day on Twitter, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? But I'm like, I can't answer that question because it's, I don't know. Like these are things that happen in real time. And the better to just take a step back, tweet a little less, not that I don't tweet way too much anyway, but you know what I mean? But take some time, consider what's going on, and then figure things out. From the moment that everybody said, when the first time Trump took a shot at Powell, I don't know, I got like 50 people. Dude. I'm like, and like, Powell's not going to give a shit. It's like, close the fucking door, Trump. I got nothing. I got work to do.
Yeah.
Just remember, these are powerful men. If you think that Jerome Powell isn't in the same league of, you know, of personality as Donald Trump, Scott Bessent, George Soros, or anything else, you're out of your mind. You don't become the FOMC chair and survive what he survived if you don't have a big pair of brass balls. So
yeah, right.
Like, just saying, guy's got bigger stones than I have. I'm, you know, without a doubt, I'd have folded under the pressure on this one ages ago.
But, yeah, I mean, yeah. Just brought up a movie, Glengarry Glenn Ross, from Practice Balls. Tom,
what's your name? What car do you drive? Fuck you. That's what I drive, or whatever the hell. Right. I came here in a Cadillac tonight. What did you drove in? You drove in a used Hyundai.
Oh, right. My friends and I could recite that movie over and over again 20 years ago. Well, Tom, listen, I am always very stingy or very selfish with your time and my time. I want to spend as much time as I can with you, and I want to thank you for your graciousness to me. Ghoul Goats and Guns, people know where to find you, but I want to give you a shout out. Where can people find you? I'll link to everything. How can they be Patreon of yours?
It's really simple. Patreon.com/GhoulGoatsAndGuns. You can find us there. The website is tomluongo.me or goldghostsandguns.com. We'll get you to the same place. And of course, my Twitter feed at the raucous head sneech Twitter feed at TFL1728.
So, yeah, I will put all that in the show notes. It's always just such a pleasure. I can't tell you, I was telling you off camera how much I just appreciate you and just spending time with you and to all my viewers and listeners. Yeah. The thing is, I get it too. People always want a piece of you. So give Tom a break, everybody.
I appreciate that. I really do. And don't get me wrong. I'm not complaining. This is in no way, manner, shape, or form a complaint.
No, I don't think.
I try to be as generous with my time as possible. But if I pull back a little bit, it's a signal that maybe we all should break.
Yeah, you need a break. I get it. Well, thank you so much, my friend. I'll get this out as soon as I can. So thank you so much, my friend.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Andy. Have a great week.